Thanks for tuning in for Cincinnati Edition. I'm Mark Purcell. It was 77 years ago this week that the Ohio River rose and caused a historic flood that affected millions of people from Pittsburgh to Paducah. Today's date, January 24th, became known as Black Sunday in 1937 as torrential rains continued. David Welke chronicles that event in his book, The Thousand-Year Flood, The Ohio-Mississippi Disaster of 1937. David is a professor of history at the University of Central Arkansas and is joining me on the phone to look back at how Cincinnati was affected by that flood. Thanks for being here today, David.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and welcome back to Cincinnati Edition. I believe we talked about the flood and your book back on the 75th anniversary, so I guess it's been a couple of years, but thanks again.
Good. Thank you.
Well, you know, tell us why January 24th, 1937 became known as Black Sunday. It was not because stocks were falling.
No, that happened a few years earlier. But Black Sunday is generally known as the worst day of the 1937 flood, not just in Cincinnati, but in Louisville, in Paducah, in Cairo, Illinois. This is in many towns, although not in Cincinnati. When the flood peaked, it's the moment when it moved from being a crisis to being something unprecedented.
Now, flooding was an ongoing concern. I mean, the river had flooded before, and the federal government was aware that something needed to be done, but no one could see this disaster in the making.
Just as a frame of reference, the crest in Cincinnati was 79.99 feet. That's 9 feet above the previous high back in 1884. So you're right. This is something that nobody could have expected, a flood like this. And the federal government at this point really didn't see itself as responsible for flood control, particularly along the Ohio River, on the lower Mississippi to an extent, but flood control on the Ohio River was just kind of an ad hoc local patchwork that disintegrated in 1937.
Today, I want to say maybe a bit complacent, because the Ohio River, while it does rise and some minor flooding from time to time, it really isn't the natural wild animal it was back in 1937, right?
That's absolutely right. And the reason for that is the flood of 1937. Since then, the federal government has taken a great deal more responsibility for flood control. And the reason that you don't think very much about floods is that the federal government has spent a tremendous amount of money building local flood walls, building reservoirs that hold back trillions of gallons of water, keeping them out of the main river, building new levees. And so the chances, you never want to say never, but the chances of something as catastrophic as 1937 happening again are very slim, so long as we maintain the facilities that are in place.
And does the fact that we have better weather and flood forecasting now help in that effort? I mean, compare what we have today with what was going on in 1937, because they didn't have Doppler weather radar back then.
That's right. And I think one of the surprising things in looking at Cincinnati's response to the flood is that initially there was a great deal of apathy in the city, and a lot of that was precisely because the weathermen had very little idea of what was coming. Cincinnati actually had a top-notch meteorologist, a guy by the name of W.C. Devereaux, who had been there for 20 years, who knew that part of the river better than anybody. But with the equipment that we had back in those days, he really had no idea what was going to happen more than 12 or 24 hours out. And so he had very little sense of what the river was going to do. And we talked about today, the 24th, being Black Friday. Just a week before that, he had said, well, the river might reach flood level, which is about 28 feet below its eventual crest. He said it might reach 52. On the 23rd of January, he said it might reach 72 feet and then level off. And obviously, we went much higher than that. So he's basically flying blind. As the flood worsens, every once in a while, he has access to a telephone, but his teletype is out. And so if you're living in the city, every day you're hearing, well, it's going to be all right. Oh, suddenly it's going to be 3 feet higher. Well, I'm not sure. And as so often happens, people tuned out the weatherman.
Cried wolf one time too many, right?
Exactly.
Well, down here by the river, we have a monument commemorating that flood of 1937. And the high water mark is, you know, marked by a piece of wood and a chunk cut out of the side of this. But it's still difficult to imagine that much water. And it wasn't just along the river. You have to remember all the creeks and streams that come into the river that were also backed up and flooding with this. So it wasn't just along the Cincinnati riverfront, but up the Mill Creek Valley here in Cincinnati that there were issues as well.
Absolutely. And I doubt that many people are out and about today. It's a little chilly, but if you happen to see the river today, one way to imagine it is that this morning the river was at about 29 feet. And so imagine 50 feet more on top of that. And
wow,
that's where it would have been 77 years ago today. And you're right, Mill Creek flooded terribly as well. Essentially, Cincinnati was split into three sections where you could only access each section by boat because of all those creeks and tributaries that flooded, as well as the Ohio. And it's worth noting that the Ohio is a 981-mile-long river. And by January 24th, all 981 miles from Pittsburgh all the way down to Cairo were above flood level.
Wow. That's a lot of water. And this was a lot of rain. Did I read in the book, 14 inches plus?
In January of 1937, Cincinnati got about 14 inches of rain. Usually in January, it gets about 3.5 inches. So this is significantly above that. But what we need to remember, of course, is that it's not just the rain on Cincinnati. It's everything coming from upstream as well. The federal government determined that in the month of January, in the 3 weeks or so prior to the flood, 165 billion tons of rain fell on the Ohio Valley. When I saw that, I tried to think of some way that I could understand what that really meant, 165 billion tons of rain. And so I did some conversion and determined that that was 41 and 1/4 quadrillion gallons of water.
Whoa.
And I didn't even know that quadrillion was a real thing. I thought that was just something that four-year-olds made up to describe something big. But it's a tremendous amount of water. It's more than we can comprehend.
Well, what kind of stories about Cincinnati did you find in your research about the 1937 flood?
Well, I think there are really two main stories of Cincinnati, one very dramatic, and then one, I think, a quiet story of leadership. The dramatic story, and I think this is, if people know anything about the flood locally, this often comes up. On Black Friday, so 77 years ago, there was a terrible fire in the Mill Creek area. There was a short circuit that ignited gasoline floating on top of the water. Estimates are about 1 million gallons of gasoline had leaked out of storage tanks from a Standard Oil storage yard. A spark hit this, and observers say there was a 1,000-foot-high tower of flame. The fire eventually stretched out about 3/4 of a mile long and about a quarter of a mile wide. A fireman who showed up on the scene told the newspaper that this is the first time he had ever been to a fire and felt like just turning around and going home. So you have to imagine this scene, that you have firemen and Red Cross volunteers and American Legionnaires standing in waist-deep water fighting this blaze. There's a tire warehouse that catches fire, and so you've got this black, noxious smoke pouring into the sky. There's an old Crossley refrigerator plant. They're desperately spraying the ceiling because there are all these volatile chemicals inside. You've got the fire burning into the night. These, you know, the kind of red reflections off the water, refrigerators and furniture floating in the water. The radio stations are going out, and so there are these rumors around the city that the whole city is burning down. Many people over in northern Kentucky are convinced that much of Cincinnati is just gone. And eventually, of course, the fire burns itself out. That's the dramatic story of the Cincinnati flood. The one that I think often gets lost in the shuffle is the story of your city manager, a quiet, tall, gray-haired, dignified-looking man by the name of Clarence Dykstra, who probably most people have never heard of. But this is a guy. He had been Cincinnati's city manager since 1930. He had come from this progressive era background of reform and experts and faith in the experts and good government. He was a true believer in the power of local government. And as this crisis hits, there are suddenly rumors of mobs of refugees storming wealthy neighborhoods and rumors of disaster. And he settles the city down and essentially says, everyone get out of my way. I can take care of this. He's a guy who's utterly uninterested in PR or politics or anything like that. He doesn't do photo ops. His office, there's nothing in it except a desk, a couple chairs, and a photograph of Albert Einstein. But he gets control of the city. He closes the movie theaters. He closes the liquor stores. He clears all the cars off the streets. He coordinates local relief efforts with the Red Cross and with the Roosevelt administration. And he gives Cincinnatians someone to listen to, someone to trust. He goes on the radio and urges them, cut your use of electricity. Most of the power plants were underwater, so there's only this trickle of electricity coming into the city. So just use one light bulb and a radio. You know, don't price gouge. Don't hoard food. Limit yourself to 1 hour of water a day, which seems ironic considering what's going on outside.
Yes, it does.
But his steady, calm voice helps to bring the city under control. His bureaucratic competence helps to organize the different relief groups and save many, many lives. And so I think he's really the unsung hero of Cincinnati's flood.
Well, we only have a minute or so left here, David. I wanted to ask the long-lasting legacy of the flood. Put it in perspective for us. Why, you know, this was a 1,000-year flood, may not happen again, but never say never.
The long-term legacy of the flood is that ultimately we are safer along the river. We're safer because of the levees. We're safer because of the reservoirs. We're safer because of the flood walls. If you're familiar with Winton Woods Lake, that's one of the reservoirs that was created after this flood. Over in northern Kentucky and in Covington and Newport, they have flood walls that are designed to resist this kind of flood. The Great American Ballpark has a flood wall designed to resist the 1937 flood. And so I think one of the long-term messages is that It required a coordinated national effort to try to protect ourselves from such a disaster. I think the other long-term message is that you can only do so much to protect yourself from nature, that when you put yourself in the face of nature, sometimes nature is going to hit back, and yes. We always need to be prepared for that.
You can find a gripping account of the 1937 flood in David Welke's book, The Thousand-Year Flood, The Ohio-Mississippi Disaster of 1937, which is available where books are sold. A link to it and more at WVXU.org. Thanks for the history and your time today, David.
Well, thanks so much.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Technical director for today's show was Kevin Rowinski. Producer was Pete Reitmeier with help from Kevin Reynolds. William White composed the Cincinnati Edition theme music. You can find archives and links for Cincinnati Edition stories at WVXU.org. I'm Mark Purcell. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. Stay warm and stay tuned for Science Friday next on 91.7.